or even repeating poses. The Sanskrit word asana originally meant seat or posture. It referred both to the act of sitting and the material you sit on. What it specifically did not mean was to stand up and move about. The earliest yoga was a science of holding still and breathing. DeRose got a taste for this kind of ancient yoga in the 1970s when he was traveling through India trying to piece together the practices of the Indus Valley. He attended a class in the foothills of the Himalayas. The studio was very basic, with a dirt floor and filled with villagers seeking to keep themselves warm during cold days. The classes were casual. Teachers joked with students. Students joked back. "Push yourself," the instructors would yell in gruff and direct voices. "You can do better than that." DeRose would recall that there were no, quote, gymnastics, anti-gymnastics, bioenergetics, occultism, spiritism, zen, dance, body expression, macrobiotics, shiatsu. Poses were done once and held for an excruciatingly long time. These long postures allowed students to focus entirely on their breathing. The class was difficult, and at the end of it, DeRose was sweaty and sore. "Nothing like yoga today," he says from across the desk. He tells me that only in the 20th century would yoga poses be combined and repeated into a kind of aerobic dance called vinyasa flow. It's this form of yoga and other hybridized techniques that are now taught in gyms, studios, and classrooms. Ancient yoga and its focus on prana, sitting, and breathing has turned into a form of aerobic exercise. This isn't to say modern yoga is bad in any way. It's simply a different practice from the one that originated 5,000 years ago. An estimated 2 billion people now practice this modern form because it makes them feel better and look better and stay more flexible in all the ways stretching and exercise does. Hundreds of studies have confirmed the healing benefits of asanas, standing up and otherwise. But what have we lost? Toward the end of our hours-long meeting, I tell DeRose about my experience in that Victorian house 10 years ago, how I had practiced an ancient pranayama technique called Sudarshan Kriya, and how it completely floored me. I tell him how a mellower version of that reaction keeps happening to me, and how it keeps happening to millions of others whenever we use traditional yogic breathing. Versions of Kriya have been around since 400 BC, and by some accounts were used by everyone from Krishna to Jesus Christ. The Kriya I'd experience was developed in the 1980s by a man named Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Tens of millions of people around the world now practice it through the Art of Living Foundation. It does much of what Tummo does, blunting stress, healing autoimmune disease, and all the rest. Sudarshan Kriya 2 was no picnic. The central method, called purifying breath, requires more than 40 minutes of intense breathing, from huffing at a rate of 100 breaths per minute to several minutes of slow breathing and then little breathing at all. Rinse and repeat. I tell DeRose about the extreme sweating, complete loss of time and lightness I felt for days after my first experience. How I'd spent the last decade looking for an explanation, conducting various lab experiments and analyzing my blood gases, scanning my brain. He sits calmly with his hands neatly folded. He's heard this all so many times before. I'd found nothing in these readouts or scientific measurements because, he says, I've been looking in the wrong place. It's energy. It's prana. What happened was simple and common. I'd built up too much prana, breathing so heavily for so long, but I hadn't yet adapted to it. This explained the waterworks and the shift of consciousness. Sudarshan is derived from two words, su meaning good and darshan meaning vision. In my case, I'd had a very good vision. Ancient yogis spent thousands of years honing pranayama techniques specifically to control this energy and distribute it through their bodies. This process took several months or years to master. Modern breathers like me could try to hack it and speed it up, but we would fail. Hallucinations, howling, soiling one's clothes. None of it was supposed to happen. It's a sign we've gone overboard. The key to Kriya, Tummo, and any other breathing practice rooted in ancient yoga is to learn to be patient, maintain flexibility, and slowly absorb what breathing has to offer. My initial experience so many years ago may have been a bit jarring, but DeRose says it also convinced me of the sheer power of breathing. In the end, it's what brought me here. After a few more rounds of Q&A, and it's time for me to go, DeRose needs to pack his things and head back to New York, where his colleagues run two bustling studios in Tribeca and Greenwich Village. Meanwhile, I need to catch a 17-hour flight back home. We exchange a few abrigados, shake hands, and I follow Pinheiro, my translator, past the glinting swords and red ribbons into the dark hallway. Before I leave, Pinheiro has offered to teach me some of the ancient yoga breathing techniques DeRose has dug up over his decades of research. We hike up to the third floor, take off our shoes, and step into a studio. This room is no different from any other yoga studio I've seen. There's that blue padding on the floor, wall-wide mirrors, and Sanskrit posters. Pinheiro kneels cross-legged so that his body is centered between the windows, casting a Buddha shadow. I take a seat across from him, and a minute later, we begin to breathe. We start with Jiha Pranayama, which involves curling the tongue to the back of the mouth and holding the breath. Then I lie down in front of him so that I'm looking up at the ceiling. The final exercise I'll be doing is intended to build prana in the body and focus the mind. Concentrate on just one fluid movement from inhale to exhale, says Pinheiro. These are the same instructions I'd heard in that Kriya session way back when, the same instructions I'd learned from Anders Olsen years later, and from that Wim Hof instructor, Chuck McGee. I know this process now. I know the ropes. I relax my throat, take a very deep inhale into the pit of my stomach. Then I exhale completely. There it is again. And here I am again. The ringing in the ears, the heavy metal bass drum thumping in my chest, the warm static flowing in my shoulders and face. The wave comes, washes over, and runs up, then turns around and recedes, back to the ocean. I've felt this all before so many times. It's the same thing the ancient people of the Indus Valley experienced 5,000 years ago, and the ancient Chinese 2,000 years after them. Alexandra David Neal warmed herself with it in a cave in the Himalayas, and Swami Rama focused it on his hands and heart. Buteyko rediscovered it in a window in the asthma ward, and Carl Stau taught it to dying veterans. As I breathe a little faster and go a little deeper, the names of all those techniques I've explored over the past 10 years all come back in a rush. Pranayama, coherent breathing, hypoventilation, breathing coordination, holotropic breathwork, adhama, midyama, uttama, embryonic breath, harmonizing breath, the breath of the master great nothing, Tummo, and Kriya. The names may have changed over the years, the techniques may have been repurposed and repackaged in different cultures at different times for different reasons, but they were never lost. They've been inside us all this time, just waiting to be tapped. They give us the means to stretch our lungs and straighten our bodies, boost blood flow, balance our brains, and excite the electrons in our molecules. To sleep better, run faster, swim deeper, live longer, and evolve further. They offer a mystery and magic of life that unfolds a little more with every breath we take. Epilogue, A Last Gasp. Nothing about this place has changed. The threadbare Persian rug, the paint-chipped window that rattles in the breeze, the rumble of diesel trucks chugging up Page Street. A few of the faces are the same, too. There's the guy with prisoner eyes, the other with Jerry Lewis bangs, and the blonde woman with that strange European accent. I find my usual spot in the corner and take a seat. It's been years since I first came to this room and felt the possibilities of breathing. A decade of traveling, research, and self-experimentation. In that time, I've learned that the benefits of breathing are vast, but they're also limited. This became disturbingly clear several months ago. I was in Portland, Oregon, and had just finished a lecture based on the contents of this book. I left the podium and walked to the lobby. A woman approached. Her eyes were wide, fingers jittery. She told me how her mother had just suffered a pulmonary embolism and was desperately in need of a breathing technique to remove blood clots from her lungs. A few weeks later, a woman seated next to me on a flight noticed photographs of skulls on my laptop. She asked me what I was working on. After I told her, she explained how her friend was suffering from a serious eating disorder, osteoporosis, and even cancer. No treatments had worked. She asked if I could please prescribe a breathing practice to bring her friend back to health. What I explained to each of these people, and what I'd like to make very clear right now, is that breathing, like any other therapy or medication, can't do everything. Breathing fast, slow, or not at all can't make an embolism go away. Breathing through the nose with a big exhale can't reverse the onset of neuromuscular genetic diseases. No breathing can heal stage 4 cancer. These serious problems require urgent medical attention. I wouldn't be alive without antibiotics, immunizations, and that last-minute rush to the doctor's office to zap out a lymph node infection. The medical technologies developed over the last century have increased the quality of life many times over. But modern medicine still has its own limitations. "I'm dealing with the walking dead," said Dr. Michael Gelb, who'd spent 30 years working as a dental surgeon and sleep specialist. He'd echoed what I'd heard from Dr. Don Story, my father-in-law, who'd worked as a pulmonologist for the past 40 years. Dozens of doctors at Harvard, Stanford, and other institutions told me the same thing. Modern medicine, they said, was amazingly efficient at cutting out and stitching up parts of the body in emergencies. But it was sadly deficient at treating milder chronic problems, all the asthma, stress, and autoimmune issues that most of us contend with. These doctors explained, in so many words and in so many ways, that a middle-aged man complaining of work stress, depression, and occasional tingling in his fingers wasn't going to get the same attention as a patient with kidney failure. He'd be prescribed a blood pressure medication and an antidepressant and sent on his way. The role of the modern doctor was to put out fires, not blow away smoke. Nobody was happy with this arrangement. Doctors were frustrated that they had neither the time nor the support to prevent and treat milder illnesses, while patients were learning that their cases weren't dire enough for the attention they sought. This is one of the reasons I believe so many people and so many medical researchers have come back to breathing. Like all Eastern medicines, breathing techniques are best suited as a preventative maintenance, as a way to retain the balance in the body so that smaller problems don't blossom into more serious illnesses. Should we lose the balance from time to time, breathing can often bring it back. Nobel laureate Albert Svante Gyorgy said it best. "More than 60 years of research on living systems has convinced me that our body is much more nearly perfect than the endless list of ailments suggests. Its shortcomings are due less to its inborn imperfections than to our abusing it." Svante Gyorgy was talking about the illnesses of our own making, also known as diseases of civilization. 9 out of 10 of the top killers, such as diabetes, heart disease, and stroke, are caused by the foods we eat, the water we drink, and the houses we live in. These are diseases humanity created. While some of us may be genetically predisposed towards one disease or another, that doesn't mean we're doomed to get these conditions. Genes can be turned off just as they can be turned on. What switches them are inputs in the environment. Improving diet and exercise, removing toxins and stressors, all these things have a profound and lasting effect on the prevention and treatment of chronic disease. Breathing is a key input. From what I've learned in the past decade, that 30 pounds of air that passes through our lungs every day and that 1.7 pounds of oxygen our cells consume is as important as what we eat or how much we exercise. Breathing is a missing pillar of health. If I had to limit my advice on healthier living to just one tip, it would be simply to learn how to breathe better, wrote Andrew Weil, the famed doctor. Though researchers still have much to learn about this endlessly expansive field, there is plenty of consensus right now on what breathing better looks like. In a nutshell, this is what we've learned. Step 1. Shut your mouth. 2 months after the Stanford experiment ended, Dr. Nayak's lab emailed Anders Olson and me with the results of the study. The major takeaway, we already knew. Mouth breathing is terrible. After just 240 hours of breathing only through our mouths, catecholamines and stress hormones spiked. A bacterial bug had infested my nose. If I'd continued breathing only through my mouth for a few more days, it might have developed into a full-fledged sinus infection. All the while, my blood pressure was through the roof and my heart rate variability plummeted. Olson's data mirrored mine. By night, we snored. A few days later, we started choking on ourselves, suffering from bouts of sleep apnea. Had we continued with all this, there's a decent chance we both would have developed chronic snoring and obstructive sleep apnea, along with the hypertension and metabolic problems that often come with it. Not all of our measurements changed. Blood sugar levels weren't affected. Cell counts and other stuff like ionized calcium remained the same, as did most of our other blood markers. There were a few surprises. I lost 2 pounds, due most likely to exhaled water loss. But trust me on this, a post-holiday mouth-breathing diet is not recommended. The nagging fatigue, the irritation, testiness, and anxiety, the horrid breath and constant bathroom breaks, the spaciness, stares, and stomach aches, it was awful. Our bodies have evolved to be able to breathe through 2 channels for a reason. It increases our chances of survival. Should the nose get plugged, the mouth becomes a backup ventilation system. The few gasping breaths Stephen Curry takes before dunking a basketball, or a sick kid huffs when he has a fever, or when you're laughing with your friends, these will have no long-term effects on your health. Chronic mouth breathing is different. The body is not designed to process raw air for hours at a time, day or night. There's nothing normal about it. Step 2. Breathe through your nose. The day Olson and I removed the plugs and tape, our blood pressure dropped, carbon dioxide levels rose, and heart rates normalized. Snoring decreased 30-fold, from several hours a night to just a few minutes. Within 2 days, neither of us were snoring at all, and the bacterial infection in my nose quickly cleared up without treatment. Ann Kearney at the Stanford Voice and Swallowing Center was so impressed by our data and her own transformation nasal breathing that at this recording she's putting together a 2-year study with hundreds of subjects to research the effect of sleep tape on snoring and sleep apnea. The benefits of nasal breathing extend beyond the bedroom. I increased my performance on the stationary bike by about 10%. Olson had more modest gains of about 5%. These results paled in comparison to the gains reported by sports training expert John Dulyar, but I couldn't imagine any athlete who wouldn't want a 10% or even a 1% advantage over a competitor. On a more personal note, those first few nasal breaths after 10 days of obstruction were so shimmering and rousing that I got a little teary-eyed. I thought about my interviews with all the empty nose syndrome sufferers who'd been told that they were crazy, that they should just quit complaining and breathe through their mouths. I thought about the kids who'd been told that their chronic allergies and congestion were part of childhood, and the adults who'd convinced themselves that choking every night was a natural part of growing old. I had felt their pain and was lucky enough to breathe life on the other side, something I'll never forget and something I'll never, ever repeat. Step 3. Exhale. Carl Stau spent a half century reminding his students of how to get all the air out of their bodies so that they could get more in. He trained his clients to exhale longer and, in the process, do what had long been considered biologically impossible. Emphysemics reported almost total recovery from their incurable conditions. Opera singers gained more resonance and tone in their voices. Asthmatics no longer suffered from attacks, and Olympic sprinters went on to win gold medals. As basic as this sounds, full exhalations are seldom practiced. Most of us engage only a small fraction of our total lung capacity with each breath, requiring us to do more and get less. One of the first stages in healthy breathing is to extend these breaths, to move the diaphragm up and down a bit more, and get air out of us before taking new air in. Carl Stau wrote in the 1960s, "The difference in breathing in the coordinated pattern and in an altered pattern is the difference between operating at peak efficiency and just getting along. An engine does not have to be in tip-top condition to work, but it gives a better performance if it is." Step 4. Chew. The millions of ancient skeletons in the Paris quarries and the hundreds of pre-industrial skulls at the Morton Collection had three things in common: huge sinus cavities, strong jaws, and straight teeth. Almost all humans born before 300 years ago shared these traits because they chewed a lot. The bones in the human face don't stop growing in our 20s, unlike other bones in the body. They can expand and remodel into our 70s and likely beyond, which means we can influence the size and shape of our mouths and improve our ability to breathe at any age. To do this, don't follow the diet advice of eating what our great-grandmothers ate. Too much of that stuff was already soft and overly processed. Your diet should consist of the rougher, rawer, and heartier foods our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers ate. The kinds of foods that required an hour or two a day of hard chewing. And in the meantime, lips together, teeth slightly touching, and tongue on the roof of the mouth. Step 4. Breathe more on occasion. Since meeting Chuck McGee at the roadside park in the Sierras, I've been practicing TUMO with dozens of others from around the world on Monday nights. That's when McGee hosts a free online session open to anyone who wants to become the eye of the storm. Overbreathing has gotten a bad rap in the past few decades, and rightfully so. Feeding the body more air than it needs is damaging for the lungs, right down to the cellular level. Today, the majority of us breathe more than we should, without ever realizing it. Willing yourself to breathe heavily for a short, intense time, however, can be profoundly therapeutic. McGee told me, "It's only through disruption that we can be normal again." That's what techniques like TUMO, Sudarshan Kriya, Wim Hof breathing methods, and vigorous pranayamas do. They stress the body on purpose, snapping it out of its funk so that it can properly function for the other 23.5 hours a day. Conscious breathing teaches us to be the pilots of our bodies, not the passengers. Step 5. Hold your breath. Several months after experimenting with CO2 therapy, I was at home reading the Sunday paper, flipping through the obituaries, when I saw that Dr. Donald Klein had died. Klein was the psychiatrist who spent years studying the links between chemoreceptor flexibility, carbon dioxide, and anxieties. He was 90 years old. It was Klein's research that inspired Justin Feinstein to pursue the NIH experiments in Tulsa. I wrote Feinstein with the news. He was crushed. He told me he'd been planning on reaching out to Klein in the coming weeks regarding what could be a, quote, game-changing discovery. It turns out that the amygdalae, those gooey nodes on the sides of our head that help govern perceptions of fear, also control aspects of our breathing. Patients with epilepsy who have had these areas stimulated with electrodes immediately ceased breathing. The patients were totally unaware of it and didn't seem to feel that CO2 rising in their bloodstreams. Communication between the chemoreceptors and the amygdalae work both ways. These structures are constantly exchanging information and adjusting breathing every second of every minute of every day. If communication breaks down, havoc ensues. Feinstein believes that people with anxieties likely suffer from connection problems between these areas and could unwittingly be holding their breath. Only when the body becomes so overwhelmed with CO2 would their chemoreceptors kick in and trigger a panic signal to the brain. The patients would start fighting to breathe. They'd get anxious. They'd have a panic attack. Eventually, their bodies adapt to avoid this panic, and they start overbreathing in an effort to keep their carbon dioxide as low as possible. Feinstein wrote, "What anxious people could be experiencing is a completely natural reaction. They're reacting to an emergency in their bodies. It could be that anxiety at its root isn't a psychological problem at all." This approach is all very theoretical and needs to be rigorously tested, Feinstein admitted. That's what he's going to be doing in the coming years. But if it's true, it could explain why so many drugs don't work for panic and other fear-based conditions, and how slow and steady breathing does. Step 6. How we breathe matters. I've chatted with Anders Olsen every few weeks since we paid through the nose in the Stanford experiment. Our talks are never dull. "I have more energy and focus than ever in my life," he told me right after celebrating his 50th birthday. Olsen is the purest kind of pulmonaut, self-taught and driven by a sense that we are missing something right in front of us, a truth both basic and essential. Through all my travels and travails, there is one lesson, one equation that I believe is at the root of so much health, happiness, and longevity. I'm a bit embarrassed to say it has taken me a decade to figure this all out, and I realize how insignificant it might sound to you right now. But lest we forget, nature is simple but subtle. The perfect breath is this. Breathe in for 5.5 seconds, then exhale for 5.5 seconds. That's 5.5 breaths a minute for a total of about 5.5 liters of air. You can practice this perfect breathing for a few minutes or a few hours. There's no such thing as having too much peak efficiency. Olsen told me he's working on several more devices to help us breathe at this rate, slowly and less. He's finishing production on a portable machine that measures nitric oxide, CO2, ammonia, and other chemicals in exhaled breath. Then there are other skunkworks to mimic the effects of perfect breathing. A carbon dioxide suit, a hat, and... Meanwhile, Google has just released an app that pops up automatically when the words breathing exercise are searched. It trains visitors to inhale and exhale every 5.5 seconds. Down the street from my house is a startup called Spire, which created a device that tracks breath rate and alerts users every time respiration becomes too fast or disjointed. In the fitness industry, resistance masks and mouthpieces like Expandalung are all the rage. Before we know it, breathing slow less and through the nose will be a big business like so much else. But be aware that the stripped-down approach is as good as any. It requires no batteries, no Wi-Fi, no headgear or smartphones. It costs nothing, takes little time and effort, and you can do it wherever you are, whenever you need. It's a function our distant ancestors practiced since they crawled out of the sludge 2.5 billion years ago. A technology our own species has been perfecting with only our lips, noses, and lungs for eons. Most days, I treat it like a stretch, something I do after a long time sitting or stressing to bring myself back to normal. When I need an extra boost, I come here to this old Victorian house in the Haight-Ashbury and sit beside the rattling window with the other Sudarshan Kriya breathers I first met 10 years ago. The room is packed now, 20 of us sitting in a circle, unkinking our necks and pulling blankets onto our laps. The instructor hits the switch on the wall, the lights dim and long shadows from the street cast across the floor. In the darkness, he thanks us for coming, brushes his bangs aside, adjusts the old boombox, and presses play. We take the first breath in, then the second. The wave comes, washes over, and runs up, then turns around and recedes, back to the ocean. Breathing methods. I'd now like to introduce Anders Olsen, the renowned pulmonaut and founder of Conscious Breathing, whom you've just heard quite a bit about. Anders will be leading several of the breathing techniques highlighted throughout the previous chapters. He's thrown in a few others for good measure. You can also find video tutorials and more at mrjamesnestor.com/breath. Okay, Anders, take it away.
Alternate nostril breathing, Nadi Shodhana. This is a standard pranayama technique that improves lung function and lowers heart rate, blood pressure, and stress. Start off by placing the thumb of your right hand gently over your right nostril, and the finger of the same hand on the left nostril. Now close the right nostril with the thumb and inhale to the left nostril very slowly. At the top of the breath, pause for a second or two, holding both nostrils closed. Then lift just the thumb to exhale through the right nostril. At the end of that exhale, hold both nostrils closed for a moment. Then inhale through the right nostril and hold. Exhale through the left. Then you repeat, continuing to alternate between the inhales and exhales. Okay, so let's try this for about 5 cycles. I'll be breathing a little heavier so you can follow along. Your breathing, on the other hand, should be very soft and quiet. Inhale through the left nostril. Hold. Exhale through the right. Hold. Inhale through the right. Hold. Exhale through the left. Hold. Inhale through the left nostril. Hold. Exhale through the right. Hold. Inhale through the right. Hold. Exhale through the left. Hold. Inhale through the left. Hold. Exhale through the right. Hold. Inhale through the right. Hold. Exhale through the left. Hold. Inhale through the left. Hold. Exhale through the right. Hold. Inhale through the right. Hold. Exhale through the left. Hold. Inhale through the left. Hold. Exhale through the right. Hold. Inhale through the right. Hold. Exhale through the left. Hold. Now feel free to continue this pattern at your own pace. About 10 or 15 cycles is a good number to start with. Breathing coordination. This technique helps to engage more movement from the diaphragm and increases respiratory efficiency. It should never be forced. Each breath should feel soft and enriching. Sit up so that the spine is straight and chin is perpendicular to the body. Take a gentle breath in through the nose, and at the top of the breath, begin counting softly aloud from 1 to 10 over and over. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And as you reach the natural conclusion of the exhale, keep counting, but do so in a whisper, letting the voice softly trail out.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Keep going until only the lips are moving and the lungs feel completely empty. Then you take in another large and soft breath and repeat. Okay, let's try this together now. Inhale through nose all the way, then gently begin counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Keep going. And as you feel you're losing your breath, start whispering the numbers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Now continue this on your own, at your own comfortable pace, at least 10 more times. More if you can. Once you feel comfortable practicing this technique while sitting, try it while walking or jogging or doing other light exercise.
Buteyko breathing techniques. Buteyko developed dozens of different breathing methods. The point behind all of them was to train the body to breathe in line with its metabolic needs. For the vast majority of us, that means breathing less. Here are a few techniques. The first one is the control pause. This is a good diagnostic tool to gauge general respiratory health and breathing progress. It involves holding the breath on an exhale to the point where you feel a sense of air hunger. If after this exercise your breathing feels labored or gasping, the breath hold was too long, then you have to wait several minutes before you try again. The next breath following your breath hold should always be very soft and controlled. So this is not a competition. The point is to relax the body and improve your breathing. And like all breath restriction techniques, never ever attempt this while driving, while underwater, or in any other conditions where you might be injured should you become dizzy. Start off by placing a watch with a second hand or mobile phone with a stopwatch close by. Sit up with a straight back. Take a gentle inhale and a slow, soft exhale through the nose, and then pinch both nostrils, closed with the thumb and finger of either hand, and start the stopwatch and hold the breath. That's it. If you can only hold your breath a few seconds at the beginning, that's okay. It takes time. A reasonable goal is to be able to comfortably hold your breath for about 45 seconds to a minute. The longer, the better. But again, don't ever push it to the point at which you're uncomfortable or gasping for air. Are you still holding your breath? If so, good job. You made it to what Buteyko considered the healthy zone. Try measuring your control pause at least once a day. First thing in the morning is the best.
The conscious breathing anchor. Personally, I prefer an exercise to boost carbon dioxide tolerance that doesn't require breath holding. Because we have a tendency to hold our breath throughout the day so much anyway. So my preference is a more rhythmic way of achieving the carbon dioxide tolerance. So imagine that you have an anchor that sinks lower and lower and lower into your body. And you do that while prolonging your exhalation. So you count to 6 on the exhale and 3 on the inhale. So while you exhale, you notice that this anchor is sinking lower and lower and lower into your body. Okay, let's try this together. So we inhale for 3 and exhale for 6 through the nose. Inhale, 2, 3, and exhale, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale for 3. 2, 3, exhale, 3, 4, 5, 6, inhale, 2, 3, exhale, 3, 4, 5, 6. Since you have your breath with you all the time, you can do it whenever you find it appropriate. Usually it doesn't take more than 3 breaths to become more present and focused.
Decongest the nose. Sit up straight and exhale a soft breath, then pinch both nostrils shut. Try to keep your mind off the breath holding, and shake your head up and down or side to side. You just keep going while holding your breath. And whenever you feel a very potent sense of air hunger, take a very slow and controlled breath in through the nose. If the nose is still congested, breathe softly through the mouth with pursed lips. Continue this calm, controlled breathing for at least 30 seconds to 1 minute. Okay, let's try it again. Pinch both nostrils shut and exhale through the mouth and hold the breath. Try to keep your mind off the breath holding and shake your head up and down or side to side. Keep going. Keep holding your breath. Keep going. And whenever you feel the need to breathe, take a very slow and controlled breath in through the nose. Okay, let's run through this 2 more times. The key here is to practice this technique at least 5 or 6 times for the best result. So, pinch both nostrils shut and exhale through the mouth. Hold the breath and try to keep your mind off the breath holding. Shake your head up and down or side to side. Keep going. Keep holding your breath. Keep going. And whenever you feel a need to breathe, take a very slow and controlled breath in through the nose. The key here, again, is to wait about 30 seconds to a minute between the cycles. So let's just breathe a few low and slow and rhythmic breaths through the nose in preparation. Okay, pinch both nostrils shut again, exhale through the mouth, and hold. Shake your head up and down or side to side. Keep going, keep going, keep holding. And whenever you feel that air hunger, take a very slow and controlled breath in through the nose. And now you can continue doing a few more cycles on your own. Yogic breathing. This is a standard technique for any aspiring pranayama student. Step 1. Sit in a chair or cross-legged and upright on the floor and relax the shoulders. Place one hand over the navel and slowly breathe into the belly. You should feel the belly expand with each breath in and then deflate with each breath out. Let's practice this a few times. Inhale deep into the belly. Exhale softly all the air out. Okay, let's do that again. Inhale deep. Exhale softly. All the air out. And one last time. Inhale deep. Exhale. Next, move the hand up a few inches so that it's covering the bottom of the rib cage. Focus the breath into the location of the hand, expanding the ribs with each inhale, retracting them with each exhale. Okay, let's try this together. Inhale deep and really expand the rib cage. Exhale softly, all the air out. One more time. Inhale into the rib cage. Exhale softly, all the air out. And finally, move the hand up further now, just below the collarbone. you're going to be breathing deeply into this area and imagine the chest spreading out with each inhale and withdrawing with each exhale. Okay, let's try it together. Inhale high into the collar area. Exhale out. One more time. Inhale. And exhale. Okay, good job. Now let's connect all these motions together in one breath. First filling the stomach, then the lower rib cage, and then the chest. We're going to be exhaling in the opposite direction, emptying the chest, then the rib cage, and then the stomach. Feel free to use one or both hands and feel each area as you breathe in and out of it. Okay, so let's now try this together. Inhale deep, down to the stomach, then the rib cage, then up to the collarbone, and exhale from the very top of the collarbone to the rib cage and deep, moving all that breath out of your stomach last. These movements feel pretty awkward at the beginning, so let's try it again. Inhale deep, down to the stomach, then the rib cage, and up to the collarbone. And exhale, starting at the very top of the collarbone, to the rib cage, and deep, moving all that breath out of your stomach. Okay, so let's try one more time. Inhale deep down to the stomach, then the rib cage, then the collarbone, and exhale at the very top of the collarbone, to the rib cage, moving all that breath out of your stomach last. Now continue this same sequence on your own for 10 more rounds. Box breathing. Navy SEALs use this technique to stay calm and focused in tense situations. It's really simple. You inhale to the count of 4, you hold for 4, and then you exhale for 4, and then after the exhalation you hold for 4. Then you just repeat it. Let's try it together a few times. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Continue on as long as you'd like. Box breathing, extended exhalation. A variation of box breathing to more deeply relax the body, that's especially effective before sleeping, is as follows. Inhale to a count of 4, hold for 4, then you exhale for 6, and hold for 2, and repeat. Okay, let's try it together. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Hold, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2,
three, four, five, six. Hold, two. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six. Hold, two. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six. Hold, two. Inhale, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Exhale, two, three, four, five, six. Hold, two. Continue for as many rounds as you'd like. Conscious breathing carbon dioxide training. This is the same as the breathing anchor, but it goes a little deeper. We're extending the exhalations, which helps us relax, and longer exhales there also increase carbon dioxide, which improves circulation. You can try this with pursed lips, through a drinking straw, or with a breathing resistance device like the relaxator. It is really simple. You inhale to a count of three and exhale to a count of nine. Okay, let's do this together. Inhale three, two, three. Exhale nine, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Inhale three, two, three. Exhale nine, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Inhale three, two, three. Exhale nine, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Continue breathing this way as long as you like. 4-7-8 breathing. This technique, made famous by Dr. Andrew Weil, places the body into a state of deep relaxation. It is very simple. You inhale through the nose to count of four, then you hold for seven, and then you exhale through the mouth for eight with a sound. Okay, let's try it for a few rounds. Close the mouth and inhale quietly through your nose to four. Two, three, four. Hold for seven. Two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, whoosh. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, nose. Two, three, four. Hold. Two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, whoosh. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, nose. Two, three, four. Hold. Two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, whoosh. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale, nose. Two, three, four. Hold. Two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale, whoosh. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. And continue as you'd like.
Acknowledgements. The human body is a complicated subject, and how that body ingests, processes, and draws energy from air, and how that air affects our brains, bones, blood, bladders, and everything else. Well, I learned over the last few years that understanding and writing about all that is another beast altogether. I am deeply indebted to the medical pulmonauts who offered me their time, wisdom, coaching, and repeated respiratory rectifications along this wild and weird journey. Thank you, Dr. Jayakar Nayak at the Stanford University Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Center for slipping away from that 10-hour brain procedure to jam endoscopes up my nose and then explain the subtleties of cilia and sphenoids over salads at Vino Enoteca. Thank you, Dr. Mariana Evans, for schooling me in the ways of disevolution and for driving me all around Philly in such a nice car. Dr. Theodore Belfour and Dr. Scott Simonetti shared countless meals over countless months to describe the countless marvels of masticatory stress, nitric oxide, and Italian wines. Dr. Justin Feinstein at the Laureate Institute of Brain Research played hooky from his NIH lab work to give me a hard lesson in brain science, amygdalae, and the panicking power of carbon dioxide. I begged and borrowed, with annotations, mind you, from several dozen elucidating books, interviews, and scientific articles penned by these respiratory renegades. They are Dr. Michael Gelb, Dr. Mark Berheny, Dr. Stephen Lin, Dr. Kevin Boyd, Dr. Ira Packman, Dr. John Finer at the University of California San Francisco Hypoxia Research Laboratory, Dr. Stephen Park at the Department of Otorhinolaryngology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Dr. Amit Anand at the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Ann Kearney, Doctor of Speech-Language Pathology at the Stanford Voice and Swallowing Center, and of course, the generous and garrulous Doctors Mike and John Mew. A crew of DIY pulmonauts welcomed me into their lives and lungs and showed me the transformative applications of breathing for real people living in the real world. Thank you to Chuck McGee III at Iced Viking Breathworks, Lynn Martin at Breathing Coordination, Sasha Yakovleva at the Breathing Center, Luis Sergio Alvarez de Rose, John Causeway Chisenhall, and Hedwan Pinheiro at the de Rose Method, Zach Fletcher at Mind Body Climb, and Tad Panther. Un grand merci to the mysterious and heretofore nameless clan of cataphiles for leading me deep below the cemetery at Montparnasse and staining my jeans with thousand-year-old human bone dust. Thanks, too, to Mark Gottling at Bodymetrics for the suite of sleep and fitness monitoring devices, and Elizabeth Ash for offering up her luxurious Parisian pied-à-terre for an entire month. Writing a paltry taxa yavla maquette feels like very thin gratitude for my partner in nasal crime, Anders Olsen, a pulmonaut so dedicated to his craft that he ditched the glory of the Swedish midsummer to spend a month in dewy San Francisco with silicone up his nose, a pulse oximeter clipped to his finger, and tape over his lips. Thank you, Anders. But next time, can we please just plug our ears instead? My early attempts to leave no stone unturned in the lost art and science of breathing left me with a pile of word rubble. This is a long way of saying that this book, like most books, took a while, and too often felt like Sisyphean drudgery. Courtney Young, my virtuosic, adroit, and often hilarious editor at Riverhead, boiled down a 270,000-word quagmire of sesquipedalian verbiage to the more digestible brick readers hold in their hands. Co-pilot literary agent Danielle Svetkov at Levine Greenberg Rostand Literary Agency not only immediately returned my whiny calls, which is unheard of in this line of work, trust me on this, but she also worked side by side with me to sculpt, hone, and polish the verbs in her own ruthless and fabulous way. Svetkov's constant support is priceless, or at minimum, worth way more than that 15%. Alex Hurd once again winced while he whittled and wetted innumerable chapter drafts down to the dagger quotes in his almost legible cursive writing. Sorry for ruining so many of your weekends, Alex. Daniel Crew at Penguin Books UK offered sage words of advice and encouragement early on and until the end. I owe mafia-level favors to the readers who provided a much-needed editorial pummeling on early versions of this tome. Thank you to the crabby and scrupulous Adam Fisher, to the exclamatory Caroline Paul, to the poetic Matthew Zupruder, the careful Michael Scherzepek, adamant Richard Lowe, flexible Ron Panna, and to the cold-hearted Jason Dearen. Just give me a call whenever you need to move that body from the trunk. My research assistant and fact-checker extraordinaire, Patricia Prisluka, scoured through several hundred scientific papers with terrible titles like Trained Breathing-Induced Oxygenation Acutely Reverses Cardiovascular Autonomic Dysfunction in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes and Renal Disease. And then she suffered the indignity of cross-checking this convolution digit by digit in the final drafts. Thank you, Patricia, for your fastidiousness and spectacular grammar. Firstly, to my lovely wife, Katie Story, who breathes a constant supply of fresh, often eucalyptus-scented air into my small office and frenzied life. Breath was written between the stacks of art books at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco, at the American Library in Paris, and on the kitchen table of that little red-doored house beside the old Catholic cemetery in Volcano, California, population 103. A note for listeners. Neither the publisher nor the author is engaged in rendering professional advice or services to the individual listener. The ideas, procedures, and suggestions contained in this recording are not intended as a substitute for consulting with your physician. All matters regarding your health require medical supervision. Neither the author nor the publisher shall be liable or responsible for any loss or any damage allegedly arising from any information or suggestion in this recording. This is James Nestor. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Breath, the New Science of a Lost Art, with Breathing Methods read by Anders Olsen. This program was directed by Mary Diltz. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2020 by James Nestor. Production copyright 2020 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.